Hello everyone and welcome to a new issue of the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. I'm Stefan Sasse, the contributor to the Tower of the Hand and author of the Nerdstream Era blog, which you might or might not know. And with me, as always, is my illustrious co-host,
Sean T. Collins. I cover Game of Thrones for Rolling Stone. I am the co-author of the official annotated A Game of Thrones with Elio Garcia Jr. from Westeros and from a certain little book called The World of Ice and Fire that we will be discussing today, spoiler alert, and Ann Grohl, the editor of the series, and I am the creator and host of All Leather Must Be Boiled and A Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones Tumblr located at boiledleather.com.
So, and today we are going to talk about the new sample chapter. We're doing a lot of those these days. And this new sample chapter is from A World of Ice and Fire, which is due to come out in at the end of the year. Something was changed up in it.
Soon-ish. Okay. Yes.
Soon-ish, yeah. Something in the next months, let's say it like that. Mm-hmm. And this book is, for those who somehow didn't get it, is a collection of background texts and histories and all that kind of stuff you usually expect to find in role-playing source books. But this one is for Westeros. It is not the much-famed GRRM Marillion, but something else entirely. It is mainly written by Elio Garcia and Linda Anginson with a little bit of stuff from George R.R. Martin. And he has now published an abbreviated account of the conquest of Westeros by Aegon the Conqueror. And we obviously have read it and we like to discuss a little bit of it today. And in our preliminary discussion just now, we already came to the conclusion that the interesting thing is not what is there, but what isn't. So, Sean, what did you think of it?
Well, it was fun. I don't know that it had a whole lot of new news, as it were. I remember that was my reaction when Martin first put the sample up on his website. I think I got in touch with you and said, can we even do a chapter on this? Because I felt like a lot of this sounded familiar. These were things that had come out, through various question and answer sessions or that we've already learned bits and pieces of in the past. But yeah, as you say, you know, going through it after we decide, the hell with it, we'll do a podcast about it anyway. There are a lot of interesting questions that you can sort of see in the negative space left by what's there. For example, this is my first one, is when Danis the Dreamer has her vision of the Doom of Valyria, the Targaryens, who it turns out are not a particularly powerful group of dragon lords, you know, pick up all their stuff and move to Dragonstone. And among their stuff is listed wives, wealth, slaves, dragons, siblings, kin, and children. Slaves was interesting, obviously, because Westeros is a slave-free society. So what happened to the slaves? Where'd they go? At what point were they emancipated or manumitted? Or I don't, you know, that's just one very, very distinct and discreet example of the kinds of questions that this sample raises throughout.
Yeah, I think regarding the slaves, the most likely answer is that we can put a latest date to it. And I guess the coronation in Old Town would be the latest possible point to get rid of your slaves and do some kind of manumission or something. And given what we learn in how's it called? You know, the Dance of the Dragons thing. Princess and the Queen, now I have it.
Yeah.
There we learn that the small folk on Dragonstone is regarding the Targaryens more as gods than as normal overlords. And I think it is likely that they simply settled those guys on Dragonstone and gave them some land to plow and some debt to keep them in line. And that slavery gradually transferred into this kind of feudalistic society we know.
Yeah, that
or
would
they simply kill them all.
That would be my guess too. I it doesn't seem likely that they killed them, but it's funny because this really, in the end, this does have some present day, quote unquote, present day implications insofar as a lot of us have been trying to figure out where Braavos will come down on the issue of an ascendant Daenerys Targaryen. You know, we all know that, that Braavos was founded as a society of escaped slaves, and that they don't do business with slavers, and so on and so forth, and they have bad blood with the Dragon Lords, but... you know, even if you were for some reason wanting to put aside the fact that Daenerys Targaryen's main political program is the emancipation of slaves and the elimination of the slave trade, I don't think Braavos would want to do that. But even if you did, you know, at what point did the Targaryens free their slaves, or at one point, you know, or whatever happened to them? You know, that that seems probably relevant in terms of, you know, them being one power over the Narrow Sea and Braavos being another, and that historical relationship developing over time. And, you know, so these questions do have ramifications for the current narrative, too.
Yeah, it is one interesting thing to note that the Targaryens obviously did not use the freeing of their slaves as any kind of PR platform. It seems to have been more of a silent process in their obvious desire to integrate themselves in the Westerosi society. So I guess Daenerys really is the first one to free slaves, in that she does it in a conscious way as a liberator.
Right. Well, I mean, the interesting thing here is that we learn that Aegon's conversion to the faith of the Seven, along with his sisters, predated the actual conquest. They were praying and accepting.
Yeah,
that was a big surprise. I mean, it just seemed like that was the kind of thing that he did in order to ingratiate himself with his new subjects. But it seems as the, it seems not only did that conversion predate the conquest, that conversion was a factor in the conquest. You know, they went and prayed on it before they decided to do what they did. You know, so perhaps, and there was a sept on Dragonstone already. He didn't build it, as far as the chapter informs us. So, you know, had the Targaryens converted before that? Had, or was this a new innovation, or was it the kind of thing where, like, you know, this was just how it's done, you know, a rich, powerful house in this area of the world would naturally have houses of worship for different denominations, which is something you still see. You know, a lot of houses that keep the Seven still have a Godswood and so on. So, but that's an interesting issue as well, particularly if it does pertain in some way to the dispensation and disposition of House Targaryen's former population of slaves. You know, who knows?
I guess we have to be a little bit careful and add a caveat here, because this is once again the unreliable narrator that we have here, and it could just be propaganda. You know, obviously there were worshippers of the Seven before, because we wouldn't have been conquered by those alien guys. You know, but I'm not entirely sure in which direction this is going. So it
right.
definitely remains an interesting question, because if religion as well as the damn table were already there before Aegon, this raises some real interesting questions about the long-term prospects of the Targaryen conquest. And I guess that is this thing that we were discussing, that we get questions but no answers really
right.
by this text. Because what we have here is a line of succession with some really interesting names. Game of the Glorious, who is he?
Right.
Damien, Gaiman, Aegon, Maegon, and Arryn, and then Aegon. And now please repeat them all in the correct order. And and that is just a long line. It just always felt like they fled Valyria, and then they sat there for a few years, plotted the conquest, and went on with it. But there are several generations between it. And they are also saying that in this fabled century of blood that followed the collapse of Valyria, in which, I guess, falls this new empire building by Volantis, and the fight between elephants and tigers that we learn about in A Dance with Dragons, there it is said that House Targaryen looked east, not west, and took little interest in the affairs of Westeros. So the question is, why did this change I think it is really obvious why they looked in the affairs of the East first, because, I mean, that was their country, and obviously they are interested in whoever is inheriting the Valyrian Empire. But then why did this change?
Yeah, I mean, the Century of Blood, which is called the Century of Blood, during which time House Targaryen looked east rather than west, coincides with the reign of Gaemon, who was successful enough to be known as Gaemon the Glorious. So whatever they did when they were looking east, apparently they did very well. But by the time of the events of any of the narratives that we've seen involving Targaryens, the Princess and the Queen, or the Duncan Egg stuff, or A Song of Ice and Fire, or even any of the history that we've gleaned about Aegon, it doesn't seem that the Targaryens have any kind of stake or holdings in anything east of the Narrow Sea. So what happened? You know, were there conquests that had been that had been lost, or were there alliances that are no longer maintained? I don't know. But whatever, I mean, something big happened, and now and then at a certain point ceased happening. You know.
Yeah. Regarding Gaemon the Glorious, I somehow have the feeling that I read somewhere that that this name does not necessarily tell us that he did glorious things, but rather that he wanted to be glorious. It might as well be a mocking name, but I'm not sure.
Well, that would be Gaemon the Vainglorious, wouldn't it?
yeah, you're right, I guess. So, yeah, my chest might be. So, yeah. Perhaps it is the fall of Volantis that really promotes this change of direction. You know, when you see that the old Valyrian Empire is no more and that there is no new empire rising from the ashes, but these free cities constantly warring with themselves, there is less danger in that for your own house. But if there was a new Valyrian Empire, the Targaryens would have been endangered because for the same reason that the Targaryen heirs are prosecuted by the Baratheons. But now that there are these cities and there is no successor to the Valyrian Empire, the Targaryens aren't really endangered, so they can look to forge their own new stuff. That might be the reason.
Yeah. And it's still, you know, this sort of butts up against a question that everyone has had for a long time, which is, why didn't the Dragon Lords conquer Westeros? Why didn't, you know, even when they were hanging out on Dragonstone, and even when it was just the Targaryens, because the Targaryens were the last Dragon Lords in the world, still quite a bit of time went by between the Doom of Valyria and the conquest of Westeros. What was it that, you know, why were they disinterested in this area? It certainly seemed like Valyria did not want for ambition. So I'm always a little bit skeptical of the idea that they were just like, eh, it's too far away. You know, they have dragons. That's the, you know, the usual considerations of distance don't necessarily apply. So I, you know, it's a very, you know, that question we don't get any answers for either. I mean, people have speculated it had something to do with them being aware in some way of skin changers and being concerned about that, or who knows? I don't. Yeah. And I don't know any more about it now than I did before I read the sample. That's another question.
What really bewildered me was this line of reasoning that ultimately led to the conquest. You know, there is this alliance making going on with the last Storm Kings, and perhaps there is a marriage. And then this guy does something stupid in that he rejects, in a pretty crass way, the offer that the Targaryens make. But, I mean, okay, now you can wage war against the Storm Kings. That I understand.
Mm-hmm.
But why do you then sit together and plan a war on the whole of Westeros, even against kingdoms that have nothing to do with it?
Yeah.
They fight the Westerlands, they fight the Reach, they even fight the North. Why?
Yeah, there's a certain, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and why all at once? Why don't they attack the Storm Kings and then the River King and so on and so forth? Why all at the same time? This just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, I mean, there's an element perhaps of shock and awe to that, you know, that we're going to conquer all of you at once. And I mean, and it worked. You know, there wasn't a successful rebellion for 300 years after that. And prior to that, the only rebellions happened within the family. No one was fucking with the Targaryens who wasn't a Targaryen, you know? So, yeah, it's, I think there's also a certain irony that the king who is cast as sort of the heavy in this story, Argilac the Arrogant, is he more arrogant than Aegon the Conqueror, who reacted to an insult by saying, I'm taking over your entire continent? You know, yeah, you're right though. Like, go after Argilac if you want, and then it seems like there's a strategic argument to be made for going after Harren the Black, who, in his own way, is just as ambitious and militaristic as Aegon, with the addition of being apparently cruel. Which, again, this is an unreliable narrator, but we haven't really heard many stories that Aegon was particularly monstrous or anything. But yeah, to rope everybody else in it is, and then on the, you know, and on the pretext of this insult, you know, I almost wonder if Argilac was already known as Argilac the Arrogant, maybe Aegon knew that this offer was going to be reacted to poorly, and that this would give him the pretext that he needed to declare war, because he did commission the painted table. That was his invention. So
that was Aegon's. Okay.
Yeah, it says, and it predated all of this business. So he had his eye on Westeros, it seems, already. So maybe this was done deliberately. Maybe he provoked Argilac on purpose.
Okay, that makes more sense, yes. Yeah. That makes much more sense. Which still leaves the question, why were they interested in ruling Westeros at all?
Right, what changed? What made them different from all the previous lineage? Oh, and that reminds me of something you kind of mentioned earlier about that lineage. There's a shift in it in the middle. It goes from Aenar to his son Gaemon, to his son Aegon, to his son Maegon. Then it passes over to Maegon's brother, Aerys. And then Aerys has three sons, and it goes to the youngest son, Daemon. And then it's straight to Arion and Aegon. So there's like a couple of shifts, actually, in a row. You know, it's directly, you know, it's father to son, to son, to son, to younger brother, to the youngest of three sons, to son, to son.
You know what might just be possible in a real irony? That the Targaryens of old determined their successors by giving them the sword Blackfyre.
Yeah.
That would be just so much more.
Right. Well, I mean, let's not, I don't know if I want to relitigate the Blackfyre rebellion, although I have to say I'm fairly sympathetic with the Blackfyre position on that particular matter.
Yeah, why?
I don't know. I mean, it just seems like you live in this society of like cool swords with names, and you know, and your dying father gives you the cool sword with the name. I don't know. That seems to me like he's sending a message.
But, oh man, that gives me the perfect opportunity for some self-advertising, because in the upcoming ebook that the Tower of the Hand produces, Hymn for Spring, I have an essay about the exact same topic, about the Blackfyre Rebellion and all this legitimacy going on there. I think you would find it interesting.
Oh, I'm excited. Hey, way to plug, man. Very successful plug. I'm going to buy that fucking thing.
Yeah, hopefully.
Well, looking over my list of other unanswered questions, another thing that I found interesting is that it refers to Dorne being ruled by the Martell princes. And I always assumed that that the lords of Dorne affecting the style of prince was a sort of compromise / concession by both the Martells and the Targaryens, you know.
In this case, Oh, sorry, go on.
You know, like, okay, Dorne, you are one of the Seven Kingdoms, you know, but we understand that that's more or less under your own largesse. You're ultimately only brought into the Seven Kingdoms by marriage, not by, you know, like, the Young Dragon's conquest, I don't think, outlives him very much, if I recall correctly. And it's really marriage that brings them into the fold. So as a, you know, you're conceding to come in. We appreciate that. We're going to recognize that by allowing you to, you won't be called kings, but nor will we make you call yourself lords. You'll be princes. But apparently that was already the style.
Yeah. I can call you out on your incredible lack of geek credibility in this matter, because the style of prince came with the Rhoynar conquest. That was this thing. So they called themselves prince and princess, since it was Nymeria's Martell because of the Nymeria's conquest.
Well, and, was Nymeria a queen or a princess?
A princess,
and
yeah.
She never called herself a queen?
Remember, John calls the name, or was it Bran? Nymeria is the name for Arya's direwolf, and they called her the warrior princess. So she's definitely a princess, and she brought this style, which allowed, of course, the Targaryens to strike this deal with the Dornish, because they didn't have to abolish king, so the Dornish could simply keep that tradition.
Right. Oh, okay. Huh. Well, you learn something new every day. Thank you very much, Stefan. Thank you.
You know, this leads me to just another thing that we have discussed in the meta section of all of this. On the Tower of the Hand, we had a roundtable a few weeks ago that concerned itself mostly with the Will of Ice and Fire and its authors and its position in fandom. And there was much a discussion going on about what place do products such as the World of Ice and Fire really have in fandom? You know, do we want a book that gives us answers to questions that are raised by the novels? So is it kind of mandatory to read supplement material in order to understand the novels? Is this the direction that Song of Ice and Fire is going? I think some of these concerns are legitimate, but I didn't really come down on this side of the argument. And I guess I just wanted to ask, what's your take on this?
I've never seen anything in all of Ice and, you know, the entire Ice and Fire gestalt, if you will, that has made me feel that if I didn't read this supplementary thing, I wouldn't have understood and valued what the actual novels were doing. And perhaps the best example of this that I can think of, because I experienced it, is when we saw the Three-Eyed Crow for the first time in A Dance with Dragons. Despite having read the Dunkin' Egg stories, I didn't recognize him at all. It was only after the fact that it was pointed out to me that I was like, oh, it's Bloodraven, how about that? But that's all it was. It was just like, oh, how about that? You know, to me it still worked on a visual level. You know, it still got across the idea that this person had been there for a long time, that serving this role had completely transformed his life. It was, you know, just a cool image. All that stuff still worked. So, you know, once it was pointed out to me that it was Bloodraven, I got something extra out of it. But, you know, it's just an unusual circumstance where, I read the supplemental material in the Dunkin' Egg stories. So once it was brought to my attention, I got all that extra stuff out of it. I didn't need to go back and do that. I had already done it, but I had just forgotten. I didn't make the connection. So
damn.
I kind of got to live on both sides of the line at once. And having done that, I feel that I didn't lose anything when I didn't remember. I maybe gained something when I was reminded, but the book still worked. And so far, I have yet to see anything from Dunkin' Egg, from The Princess and the Queen, from stuff that Martin has said in Q&As or in, you know, on his blog that wound up, you know, being accepted as canon, or from this, that I feel that I would have genuinely lost comprehension or enjoyment had I not read it, you know?
Yeah, I'm feeling the same way. Though I have, of course, to point out that I didn't make the connection that you're not credibility is taking another swing here.
Man, you're giving me a hard time this episode.
Yeah, I know. I just have to crunch the warm and fuzzy feeling of the episode's past.
Yes. The hostility. Now we're at war.
It's a dance
of the dragons.
But people always complain that we agree so much, so I guess we ramp up the hostility a little bit.
Yeah.
In order to give them something. No, that was just a point that came to me right now. I mean, I will buy World of Ice and Fire. I think you will too from your comments so far. And I have pretty much enjoyed every product from Song of Ice and Fire, except the comic book, which I really hate, and the Wits and Wisdom of Tyrion Lannister, which I haven't bothered with, to be honest. But that's about it.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that we all have experienced the Wit and Wisdom of Tyrion Lannister. I'm not sure it's necessary to re-experience it, but yeah, I enjoy this kind of thing. I do my best to prioritize what's important. And, you know, I just ultimately will get more out of a novel than I will get out of a world book or out of a wiki or out of a whatever. But I get a kick out of this stuff. I don't feel like it's overwhelming. I don't feel a sort of scramble to keep up with all of it. Although I do. But, you know, for me, my background is in comics, as you know. And in superhero comics, I learned very early on. I mean, I came fairly late to superhero comics, I think, relative to a lot of people. And I learned very quickly that completism is a mug's game. At least for me. At least for how I interact with these things. You know, I prioritizing enjoyment is almost psychologically necessary for me, I think. And literally, I had a big therapeutic breakthrough in the mid-2000s where I was in therapy and I was feeling bad about how one of the only things I was enjoying legitimately in my life at the time was, like, Battlestar Galactica. And my therapist said to me, "That's great. If you enjoy something, enjoy it. You know? Go with that." And I was like, "Hey, you're right." That was a huge, huge moment for me. And so anytime that I start to feel like I'm interacting with art in a way that I feel I have to rather than want to, I stop, you know? And so if it got to the point where I felt like I was having to buy all this other shit and it was feeling more like homework than the normal process of consuming art and fiction, I would stop. So far, I'm enjoying myself, and that's the important thing.
Okay. That's a high note we can end the podcast on.
Yes. I try to leave everyone with a little bit of inspiration. All right, well, thank you, everyone, for listening, and thank you, Stefan. It's fun having yet another sample chapter of yet another thing. And, who knows? Maybe soon we'll have a sample chapter from the follow-up to The Princess and the Queen, which is going to be in his next cross-genre anthology with Gardner Dozois. Which comes out in like June or something. Prince. That's like a month or two from now.
Yeah, I hope we will get in another podcast between then, because else we have, what, 4 or 5 in a row about sample chapters?
Yeah, no, it seems likely. And if you're a listener out there who is trying to avoid sample chapters or is just generally tired of, you know, we have other things in the pipeline. We have other ideas. We'll be back in some other, you know, we will reconfigure like a transformer and come back at you, and it'll be very exciting.
Okay, I try an Austrian impersonation. I'll be back.
There you go. I rely on your old world charm for things like that, Steph.
So. Yeah, right.
All right. Well, thanks again. Thanks, Stefan, for talking to me about this stuff, and thanks, everybody,
for
listening.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye.